Sai FM 101.9 megahertz of life.
Good morning and welcome to Jewish History and Destiny. I'm Rabbi Danny Saxton, listening to 101.9 Chai FM. Always wonderful to be with you on a Friday morning, a freezing cold Friday morning here in Johannesburg. Today is the 5th of June. Tomorrow is the 6th of June. And the 6th of June is a very significant day in the history of the world. I'm sure our listeners know what I'm referring to and see where I'm going, because the 6th of June is the anniversary of the D-Day landings in Normandy in 1944. So what I would like to do with you in the short time that we have together is discuss D-Day at 82, the 82nd anniversary of D-Day, enduring lessons for a conflict with Iran, the important lessons that we can and should learn from the D-Day landings from World War II, and they shed light on our current situation and the present day conflict with Iran. So there are two, what I want to do is go through with you some of the incredible facts and information about the D-Day landings and why it was perhaps the most significant day of all of the 26,525 days of the 20th century, the most important day of the 20th century. So we'll see why that is, and we'll paint the picture and get a bit of a perspective and see the incredible scale of the D-Day invasion. But firstly, just to mention some very important and relevant lessons to learn that apply to our current world today. And the first one is that we see from D-Day and the massive scale and significance of D-Day and its importance, how critical the time was back then 82 years ago. And we had a major monster in the form of the Nazi regime that had dominated all of Europe at the time. So by the time of the D-Day landings, we had most of Europe under the control of the Nazi regime. France, Belgium, Netherlands, Norway, Denmark, Poland, large parts of the Soviet Union, large parts of Italy were all under Nazi control. And of course, the Nazis also had puppet states in Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, Slovakia. And so they controlled Europe. Much of what the EU is today was under Nazi control, all of the tremendous resources. And the Nazis were the main power and force in the world. They were 6 months away from building a nuclear weapon. How did that happen? How did the world allow that to be? And if it weren't for D-Day, the Nazis would have developed nuclear weapons, and one could only imagine what the world would look like today if it weren't for the success of D-Day 82 years ago. And the lesson to learn is that the world has to stand up against the fundamentalist totalitarian regimes that appear, that pop up in the world. 82 years ago, it was the Nazis, and today it's Iran. The Iranians were weeks away from developing a nuclear weapon if it weren't for the war that opened up a few months ago. And it's so important and critical that these fundamentalist regimes are stopped, and that the world does stand up to them, and that the world does prevent them from consolidating their power and building their forces, because eventually they're going to have to be stopped. Either they will take over the world and carry out, especially today we look at the Iranian regime, and they have an apocalyptic view of the world, and based on Shiite Islam, that the world must turn Muslim, and it's their responsibility and duty to enforce Sharia law on the entire world. And that's how the world would reach its ultimate perfection, and its purpose is by enforcing Shiite rule on every country of the world. That is their view, and they're fighting very hard to to achieve their goals. And obviously the first place they need to conquer and take back is Israel. And so all of those missiles and nuclear warheads will be faced towards Israel. And it won't stop there at Israel, but it will continue with the rest of Europe and all of the world. And unless they are stopped sooner rather than later, they'll get bigger, the monster will grow, and they'll get bigger and stronger, and it will result in more people dying and more lives being lost and more suffering to the world. And the future of the free world and democracy depends entirely on standing up to these megalomaniacs and to these crazy fundamentalists. And the policies of appeasement, we learned so clearly from World War II that Chamberlain, who was the Prime Minister of England, he appeased Hitler. And Hitler, he didn't go from zero to 100 overnight. Hitler probed, Hitler tested, Hitler pushed the envelope, and he was waiting to see the reaction of the Allies. And when he saw that there was no reaction at all, and that it was free to take Austria and free to take Sudetenland, and then free to, he went into Poland. He was convinced that the Western democracies are weak and that he had the freedom to do as he wished. And he was right that if they had stopped him early on, the 65 million people that died in World War II would not have died, and it would have saved millions and millions of lives, and certainly the 6 million Jews that were murdered by the Nazis. But because the Allies were weak and they backed off and they gave him space and they appeased him, he built his forces and he consolidated his power, and he was able to wreak the unbelievable destruction and suffering of World War II, of the Holocaust. And if it weren't for the mammoth efforts of the Allies and of D-Day, he would have kept going. He wouldn't have stopped. And so it's exactly the same with Iran. They need to be stopped sooner rather than later. Otherwise, the longer we leave them, the greater the destruction and suffering they will cause upon the world. That's lesson number one, which I think is an enduring lesson and something that we would be wise to take note of and learn from history and be proactive in preventing the mistakes of history happening again. That's lesson number one. Lesson number two is I think we should have hakara satov. We should have appreciation of the leaders of the countries and of the soldiers that do stand up and stop these crazy fundamentalists from destroying freedom, from killing millions, from taking over the world. And so we should certainly be very grateful to those brave soldiers who carried out the D-Day landings and operations. There were 3 million soldiers involved. We're going to see the details in a few moments. And their leaders who boldly carried out this plan, which was very, very brilliantly conceived of and executed. And so we should be very grateful to the leaders of the Allies of World War II, to the generals of the Allies of World War II, and to the soldiers who carried out these brave missions. And likewise today, we should be grateful to President Trump for standing up against Iran, for the soldiers of the United States Air Force and United States Army and United States Navy. We should be grateful to Prime Minister Netanyahu for bravely standing up against Iran and stopping them before they can't be stopped anymore. We should be very grateful to the soldiers of Tzahal and to all the forces that are involved in defending Israel, in defending the state of Israel, and in defending the Jewish people. So certainly the least we could do is appreciate their sacrifice and their commitment and their bravery in fighting against the forces of evil in the world. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
We're talking about the lessons learnt from D-Day at 82, enduring lessons for a conflict with Iran. Let's now discuss the incredible operation of the D-Day landings. We did mention the context in that the Nazis controlled most of Europe and they had an absolutely massive empire. They also controlled large parts of the Soviet Union, and they were on their way to controlling most of the Western world. And it was clear to the Allies that they would need two fronts in order to destroy the Nazi empire and regime. The Eastern Front already was in full action June 1941. So the Nazis attacked the Soviet Union June the 23rd, 1941, Operation Barbarossa. And so by 1943, the full-scale war on the Eastern Front was in action. And Stalin spoke. He met his allied war leaders in Churchill and Roosevelt in Tehran in November 1943. And he said, time is running out. We desperately need to open a front in the West, a Western front against the Nazis. And the Allies knew that, and they had been planning that for a long time. And Stalin was getting frustrated with them that they were delaying the attack on the Western Front. But they committed to Stalin that in early 1944, they would do so. And so now they had to make concrete plans for this operation. And the first thing to do was to select a leader who would lead this attack of the Nazi regime on the Western Front. The head of the Allied ground forces was General Bernard Montgomery. He ran the army. The head of the Allied air forces was Chief Marshal Lee Mallory. And the head of the Allied navy was Admiral Bertram Ramsay. They were all British. And so it would make sense, since the Americans would have a major part to play in the operations on the Western Front, the overall head would need to be an American. And the Allies had, at first they wanted a George C. Marshall, who was the chief of staff, but Roosevelt said he was indispensable and had to remain in America and run the army in America together with Roosevelt, didn't want to let him go. And so they selected one of the shining stars in the American general staff. His name was Dwight David Eisenhower. And in fact, Eisenhower in 1942 had presented Marshall with a plan to attack the Nazis from the West. And he said that's the only way to defeat Germany is to attack them from the West and go straight into Germany. And so he had thought about this for a long time. And he was selected to be the supreme commander of the Allied Expeditionary Forces. Eisenhower was a very talented organizer. He was a very brilliant man. He was likable. He had a wonderful sense of humor. He was able to deal with stress and pressure and difficult individuals. And so he was the perfect man for the job. He was a genius in logistics and in organizing large-scale operations. He ran the invasions of North Africa and Italy very successfully. And so he was the perfect candidate for the job. Roosevelt approached him, and he, together with Marshall, and Eisenhower said he would take on this daunting task on one condition, that he would be the supreme commander and his decisions would be final. They accepted his terms, and he went to meet with Churchill, and he told Churchill the same thing, and Churchill also agreed. Eisenhower arrives in England at the beginning of 1944, and he now has to plan and execute this huge operation. Now, it was so huge because the Nazis had fortified their western border. It was known as the Atlantic Wall. It was 2,687 kilometers of fortifications. Rommel, who was one of the best German generals, he was sent to France in November 1943, and he was given the task of strengthening the defenses on what was called the Atlantic Walls, all the way from Norway in the north to Spain in the south. And the Atlantic Wall had 13 million tons of concrete, 1.4 million tons of steel. There were huge bunkers and massive guns and thousands of machine gun nests. And the fortifications were significant. They had in the low tide, they had laid millions of mines and these big anti-ship mechanisms, you know, those big X's. I'm sure you can picture them and seen pictures, and a lot of them were mined. And so it was quite a significant task to breach this Atlantic Wall and the German fortifications on their western border facing the Atlantic Sea. And so the I actually saw an incredible interview of Eisenhower, and you can find it on YouTube, where Walter Cronkite went back to Normandy with Eisenhower in 1964, 20 years after the invasion. And I've read, this is really one of my pet interests, as you can hear, I'm very excited about it. So I've read many books about D-Day and about the D-Day operations and planning and landings. And to hear from Eisenhower in this interview was absolutely incredible, because to hear it from the man himself, I learned so many new things. And he said, Eisenhower, that one of the most significant developments was after he arrived in England, the British engineers reported to him that they had a ability, they had the concept and the and they had created the wherewithal to create their own mobile harbors, which says Eisenhower was the game changer, because up until then, the way, imagine planning to send an army across the channel, an army big enough to challenge the Nazis, which was the most formidable fighting force in the world at the time. So an army fights on the stomach, as Napoleon said, and you need a tremendous amount of logistics to back up the army. So you have to land the soldiers, and then you have to be able to back up the soldiers with all the forces that they needed, in terms of their military material and the ammunition, as well as the food, etc. So one would have to create a beachhead and back that up. It was not simple to do. And so up until then, they thought that they would have to be able to conquer deep water ports. But they experimented with that idea, the Allies, and they tried a landing in a deep water port in a place called Dieppe in France in August of 1942. And it was a complete disaster. The Germans were so well entrenched, and they absolutely slaughtered the British and Canadian special forces that tried to land and take this port. And they realized that to take a conventional deep water port that was well defended was very, very difficult. So with this new development of mobile harbors, it gave the Allies the opportunity to plan an invasion for the beaches. And they would land on beaches, and then they would be able to develop, bring in their own harbors. The way they would do that was they would take old warships and sink the old ships, and they would be the breakers of the waters. And then they would bring in these huge concrete slabs, and they would drop them in place, and that would be the area of these mobile harbors. So it was it gave the Allies much more flexibility and leeway in planning the operations. So Eisenhower could look at beaches in which they could land, and that expanded his possibilities tremendously. What was vital and essential, the success and failure of the D-Day landings was based on the ability of the Allies to deceive the Germans. Because if the Germans knew when and where they were coming, they would place their best troops there, and they would most certainly push the Allies back into the sea. The Germans had, although they were waging a huge war on the Eastern Front against the Russians, they still had millions of soldiers in France and on the Atlantic Wall, and they And they had some of the best soldiers in the world in their panzer troops. And if the panzers were near where the landings took place and would be able to get there quickly, they would certainly be successful at pushing back the forces coming in to the beaches. And so the what was critical was the Allies' ability to deceive the Germans, to think, to not know where the landings would be. And then by the time they had landed and they would have sufficient time to create a beachhead, and the troops that would reinforce those frontline troops wouldn't get there in time. In other words, they would prevent them from getting there, and they would then, and that critical time would enable the Allies to land more troops and more ammunition, and they would then be able to push forward. So if they didn't deceive the Germans and the Germans were waiting for them, the landings would almost certainly be a failure. And so the Allies put a tremendous amount into this deception. And what they did is they developed a whole number of double agents, agents that the Germans thought were their successful intelligence agents in England, but really they were double agents, and they were feeding the Germans material that the Allies wanted the Germans to believe. So there was the main person that the German intelligence services relied on was a person whose code name was Garbo. And he claimed that he had a number of informants in the major ports in England. And the Allies actually gave this double agent accurate information that they fed back to the Germans. And so he built up his credibility before the D-Day operations. And so they thought that this guy was the real deal and that he did have genuine agents on the ground. He didn't have any agents. It was all a fabrication of the British intelligence. But he did feed them some accurate intel, and so he had built up his credibility. And what the concept of the Allies was, well, what was most likely was that they would attack, the attack would take place at Pas-de-Calais. That was the most logical thing, because Dover, the British port of Dover was only 42 kilometers from Pas-de-Calais. And so the channel is a notoriously rough stretch of sea to cross. The weather was unpredictable, the currents are very strong, and it's very difficult to cross an invasion force over such a body of water. And so the simplest place would be the shortest area, which would be Pas-de-Calais. Whereas the distance of Dover to Pas-de-Calais was 42 kilometers. The distance of southern England, of Portsmouth, which was the main port in southern England, to Cannes, which was in Normandy, where the actual landing took place, was 186 kilometers. So it was more than four times more the distance. So the Germans knew that the British wouldn't want to have to travel that distance. And therefore, it was most likely the attack would come from Pas-de-Calais. And so the British knew that. And what they did is they set up false armies in Dover. And they fed information to Garbo to tell the Germans that that his agents on the ground were reporting that there were huge troop buildups in the area of Dover. And they created an entire army, which was a fake army, which what had actually happened was George Patton, who was one of the great generals of the Allies, he was a very bombastic, strong personality, really built in the German mold. He was the only general that the Germans actually feared. And he was a very strong, ambitious, aggressive person. And what had happened was he was involved in the landings in Italy. And one of his troops had got injured and had PTSD. And Patton went to visit him in hospital. And this man saw Patton and said, "I can't come back to the front lines. I'm not able to." And Patton said, "What are you talking about?" And he slapped him. And the high command of the Allies was very, very upset with Patton that he behaved such a way to one of his troops, and they sidelined him for the D-Day invasions. And that was absolutely devastating for Patton. But anyway, they still used him to their benefit, and they created this fake army. They called it Patton's Ninth Army. And they had these blow-up tanks, you know, like a blow-up, and you know, like the kids jumping castle blow-up, and blow-up jeeps and blow-up trucks. And they fooled fields of these blow up fake army equipment. And so they filled up the whole area of Dover with this fake equipment. And so the Germans were getting information from Garbo that there's a huge, huge troop buildup in the Dover area. They send their reconnaissance planes and they take pictures from the sky and they see these fields, huge areas filled up with all of these supplies and equipment. And also the Allies created fake radio communication. They set up radio communications, which were supposed to be for the 9th Army. And they were all day long sending messages, send troops here, send equipment there, send these units over here, and radio signals. And so they, it all seemed to be in place, that the intel that they got from the most reliable agent, the pictures they had from the reconnaissance planes, and the radio communications that they were hearing were all pointing to the fact that they were building, the Allies were building up this massive troop base in Dover, and therefore certainly the main attack would come to pass the Calais. And so that was very, very important and critical for the success of the D-Day landings. Now, there was quite a different view in the German High Command, because as I mentioned, Rommel was sent to fortify the Atlantic Wall. And the head of the German army in France was General von Rundstedt. Now, Rommel wanted the crack forces, the panzers, to be right by the coast. Von Rundstedt said that was not clever because the coastline is a very long, it's 2,600 kilometers, the coastline. We don't know where they're going to land. And we think they're going to land past the Calais. So they kind of came to a compromise. Some of the troops were near the coastline and others were in strategic areas where they could send them once an invasion took place. Everybody knew, the Germans knew that there was, the Allies were planning an invasion in the west. And so Rommel knew that the first 24 hours would determine the outcome of the war. And if they were able to create the bridgeheads in the first 24 hours, so the Allies would win the war. And if they were able to push them back, then the Germans would win the war. And so he was very concerned that if the best troops were not able to get there quickly, they would never get there at all. And he was right. Rommel was right. I mean, Rundstedt was wrong. And so what actually happened, there was something else called the transportation plan, which was very significant as well in terms of the outcome of the D-Day operation. But I'll share that with you when we come back in a moment.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
I'm Rabbi Danny Saxton of Sunny Road, Kehillah, and you're listening to Jewish History and Destiny. We're talking about the D-Day landings, 82 days tomorrow since the landings in Normandy and the incredible events that happened on D-Day that led to the Allied victory and defeat of Nazi Germany. We've been discussing that what was critical was that the Nazis wouldn't know where the Allies would land. Because if they did know that, they would unquestionably defeat the landing troops and push them back into the sea. And so a tremendous amount was put into deception, and they led the Nazis to believe that the main attack would be in Pas de Calais and not in Normandy, which was further south in France. And another very important factor was what was called the transportation plan. Eisenhower knew, as Rommel did, that the success and failure of the landings would depend on whether the German reinforcements and crack panzer troops could arrive quickly or whether they would be delayed. And so what Eisenhower planned was to attack and destroy the transportation lines in France. And he had a big clash with the head of the Air Force, who was Air Chief Marshal Lee Mullery, who Mullery said, and together with the other Air Force generals of the United States Army, they felt that the way Germany would be defeated would be to bomb Germany to the ground, to destroy the German industry from the air, and that would ultimately prevent the German army from rearming itself and for continuing to fight the war, and the Allies then would overpower them on the battlefield. So that's what that was the view of the Air Force. But Eisenhower knew that the D-Day landings wouldn't succeed if they were not able to prevent the Panzers from arriving and push and engaging in the battle. And so Eisenhower said that we need to bomb France, not Germany. If we want the landings to succeed, we have to bomb France, because we have to bomb all the transportation lines, the railway lines, the roads, the bridges, to prevent these troops from arriving where the frontline battles are taking place. And they reached an impasse to the extent that Eisenhower went to Churchill, and he said to Churchill, unless you give me control of the Air Force, I'm out of here. I'm not going to be a part of this invasion. And Churchill agreed with him, and so permission was given to Eisenhower. And as a result, a massive air campaign took place, which was called the Transportation Plan, in which the Allied bombers bombed huge areas of France. They couldn't just do the Normandy area, because it would then be obvious that that's where the invasion would take place. So they bombed the railway lines, the railway yards, the bridges, the roads, all over France. Now, Churchill was very concerned that if they did that, the French public would never forgive them, would take France decades to recover from this. And they discussed it with General de Gaulle, who was the head of the French Free Forces in France, and of France. He was in Britain in exile. And de Gaulle said, it's a small price to pay to free France from the tyranny of the Nazis and Nazi control. And he spoke, they had the French Free Radio had broadcasts, and he, in those broadcasts, said that despite the bombing from the Allies, this is something that France needs to endure in order to defeat the evil empire of the Nazis. And so that made it easier for them to do it, and they carried out the transportation plan with great success. It was very successful. And because they had done that, it prevented the backup reinforcements of the Nazis coming when the invasion took place, and it was very significant in the success of the D-Day landings. The next factor, which was very significant, was the weather. When would they go? Now, they originally had planned the invasion. Now, nobody knew where and when. Only the high command of the Allies knew the details. There was tremendous secrecy, because, as we mentioned, secrecy was critical, because if the Germans knew that they were attacking Normandy in the south, they would send their troops there, and the landings would fail. So there was complete secrecy. There were 3 million troops in the south of England, and instead of them being in Dover, as the Germans thought, they were in the other areas in the south of England. They were in Portsmouth and Southampton and Weymouth and Exeter and Dartmouth and Plymouth. That's where the main areas of the Allied troops were, and not in Dover. And they were locked up, these troops, for months. They weren't allowed to get out of their camps. The British government even stopped diplomatic communication from embassies to their countries, because they knew that secrecy was critical. They had planned the invasion for June the 4th. And obviously a big factor, as mentioned, crossing the Channel and landing these 150,000 soldiers would be the weather. And because the weather in the Channel is always bad, and there were many storms, especially in the summer storms at that time of year. And so they relied very heavily on the chief meteorologist. His name was Captain Stagg, and he was the best there was in England. And he had worked with Eisenhower since Eisenhower arrived in England, so Eisenhower trusted him. And he came in to meet the high command of the Allies at Eisenhower's headquarters in Portsmouth. And he met with them on the 3rd of June. I think it was a bit before, it was like 2nd of June. And he told them that the planned invasion for the 4th of June, it would be a massive storm, and it would be a complete failure and a disaster. And they stepped outside. It was 2 days before the planned invasion, and there were clear stars. Guys, there was no storm at all. And they looked at him and said, what are you talking about? He said, trust me, I can see. Now, what actually happened is the Allies had far more accurate predictors of the weather than the Germans, because the weather came from the west. And the Allies had stations, weather stations, in the western areas that were coming in towards Britain and the Channel. And so they could more accurately predict the weather. And so because Eisenhower trusted Stagg, he said, okay, we're going to delay the operation for 24 hours. And so on June the 4th, they met again at 6:30 in the morning, which is exactly the time that the invasion was supposed to take place. And Eisenhower said that his headquarters in Portsmouth said the building was shaking, said he had never, ever seen a storm of that magnitude. And he was very relieved and grateful that he listened to Stagg and that they postponed it. And so they had to decide what to do, you know, and the obviously secrecy was so critical, and they didn't want to let on. The longer they delayed, the more chance there would be that the Germans would work out that the real buildup of forces was in the south of England and not in Dover. And then the whole operation would be at stake, would face failure. And so Eisenhower had to decide what to do. And he turned to Stagg and he said, how long is the storm going to last? And Stagg said, based on my reports, there's going to be a temporary lull in 24 hours on the 6th of June. And that'll be enough time to land the invading forces. And they all looked at Eisenhower. And a lot of the history books say that Eisenhower, he then stopped for 5 minutes and thought about it. But he said in his interview that he looked at the generals and he thought about it. He said for about 45 seconds and he considered the risk of postponing and of the true buildup of forces being revealed to the Germans against the weather. And he said, it's a go. And he gave them the thumbs up. And they all then reported, and the operation was a go. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment, and we'll hear about the incredible landings on D-Day.
High FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
You're listening to Jewish History and Destiny. We're discussing 82 years since the D-Day landings. And the decision is made by Eisenhower to carry out the invasion on June the 6th, 1944, and it's a go. And the Allies were expecting, according to the experts, they said that the first wave of soldiers would face a 70% attrition. 70% of the first wave will be killed. That's what the Allies are expecting. And they are absolutely beside themselves. They don't know whether the landings are going to be a success or not. That is the largest amphibious operation in the history of the world. Absolutely massive operation, 6,000 ships, 12,000 planes, 3 million troops are involved, 150,000 troops landed on the day, 23,000 paratroopers are sent behind enemy lines to try and attack them from behind and disable their big guns and their firing onto the beaches. And so the landing is on. There are 5 beaches in which the Allied troops landed on. Sword Beach or the British, Juno's Canadian, Gold is British, Omaha is American, and Utah is American. Those are the 5 beaches in Normandy upon which they landed. And they expected, for there to be a huge attrition rate in which thousands would be killed. And the original reports back to their Allied commanders was that the going is rough and things aren't going well. And what actually happened is there was a huge part of the plan was there would be a huge aerial bombardment just before the troops would land. The troops were due to land at 6:30 in the morning. 6:30, it depends which beaches, some 6:30, some 7:30, some 7:45. And so firstly, there would be a huge aerial bombardment of the fortifications and bunkers on the beaches. And secondly, there would be a massive naval barrage and the firing of the huge guns on the ships onto those beach entrenchments and fortifications. I've heard interviews from veterans who were on the ships and who were soldiers that were involved in the first landings. And they said when they saw those planes coming over and they saw those bombs being dropped, and then they heard the big guns being fired of the massive naval barrage, they thought they're going to land on those beaches and it's going to be a breeze. They're going to walk across those beaches. But as it turns out, there was a huge cloud bank So none of the bombers actually hit their targets. They all missed. And also the naval fire was not accurate at all. And so pretty much the entire German fortification system was in place when they landed on those beaches. But they were brave and they were strong. And the attrition rate was much lower than they originally expected. So Churchill expected 20,000 to be killed in those first waves. And only, thank God, 5,000 were killed. And Sword Beach, there were 630 British that were killed. On Juno, 63 Canadians. On Gold, 413 British. On Utah, 193 Americans. They were very lucky, the Americans. They were meant to land in one place, but they misnavigated and they ended up in another place. And only if they were going to land in the first place, there were huge German fortifications there, and they landed in a place where there was very little defense. So only 193 were killed. Omaha was the worst. Omaha, 2,500 Americans were killed. The original waves of Omaha were absolute carnage. It was like target practice for the Germans, and it was very difficult to get a foothold in Omaha. But eventually they managed to do so, and the paratroopers also were very successful at attacking the Germans from behind, and the invasion was a great success, thank God. And so the Allies were able to create those bridgeheads and bring in their reinforcements and their supplies. And that was the beginning of the end for the Germans. And it was a big struggle, the battle in Normandy. But the Allies were successful and they prevailed. And now the Germans had to deal with a massive two-front war. And eventually they just couldn't manage and they were overrun by the Allies. But it all was contingent on the success of these landings and the incredible planning of the Allies, the outstanding deception, the superb execution of the soldiers resulted in D-Day being the great success that it was and being the beginning of the end of the Nazi regime, thank God. And therefore, undoubtedly, that was the most significant day of the 20th century. And as I mentioned in the beginning, we should learn the lessons of D-Day, and that is we have to stand up to the dictators and the megalomaniacs of the world before they can carry out their nefarious plans. And we should be very grateful to all those involved in these brave missions that destroy the evil forces of the world. Thank you so much for listening. Wishing everybody a wonderful Shabbos.